from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll chat with artist Mark Pack about his newest work.
I'll get a preview of the Carmel Community Players production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
And I'll find out what's going on at the Richmond Art Museum. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Artist Mark Pack has developed a reputation and a following for his sculptural work created out of carved acrylic paint. Yes, that's correct. Sculptures made from layers of paint. If you haven't seen them, they look a bit like colorful rock specimens from a natural history museum. Now Mark is working on a much larger piece using the specimens as building blocks. Travis DiNicola found out more.
Mark, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to have you in the studio again.
And it's great to be here.
Well, I'm a big fan of your work. You know that. People who listen to Art of the Matter know that. Tell me, before we talk about the new work that you're going to be showing at the exhibition Intersections, which is going to be in March, give us sort of just a description of the work that you've become known for here in Indianapolis, the work that I've really grown to love. Essentially your specimen work. Tell us about sort of what that is and what that looks like.
The specimen work comes out of some of these other paintings that I physically cut pieces out of my paintings and then frame them like one would a rock specimen or a shell specimen, something that's sort of a record of nature. And really I'm sort of ingesting things about nature that I see in life and creating these pieces that sort of reflect on how objects in nature are made.
You mentioned the paintings that you cut it out of. You're also actually creating other paintings as well.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a real, use acrylic paint and you layer it in such a thick, heavy way that it no longer is even like paint. It becomes, I mean, like this, like fossilized medium of paint almost.
Right.
I find the work really fascinating. And what you're getting out of it, and sort of the abstracted shapes and colors, but beyond that, I mean, it becomes sculptural. I mean, your paintings are actually more three-dimensional than they are two-dimensional.
Exactly. Yeah.
Taking that, I know you've been talking about wanting to sort of create a larger body of work, both more work, but also physically like a larger piece, an installation. Is that what Intersections is about, or?
Well, it's going to be, I'm going to display this large sculpture that I'm working on there.
Okay.
And it's sort of a weird piece because the way that I'm beginning to think about it is that it might be a piece or is going to be a piece that may grow as I show it more.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one in theory could say that in that particular show it might not be completely finished because it could be a piece that would change as I show it.
Well, let me go back a second here, because I remember one of the last times I saw some of your work exhibited was at the Orange event back in the fall, which is always just a great, cool, arts happening event. And you had some work there where you had taken some of your specimen work, larger than some of the stuff I'd seen before, and they were sort of multiple pieces sort of attached and laid on top of each other, almost like sort of the falling rock on the side of a road, but constructed. And now with the new pieces, is it a sense of like sort of building onto that even more? I mean, sort of taking, like multiple sections of work and adding them together, or?
I was thinking about how a person stacks rocks.
Yeah.
Basically, sort of, how, like if you go to the beach or if you go, you're out in Inuit tribes used to stack rocks to sort of to mark their path,
right, like for hunting grounds
and landscapes and stuff like that. Exactly. So I'm thinking about it as that.
Okay.
It's a piece where I'm going to take smaller and larger sections and sort of stack them to make a bigger piece.
Okay.
And that stacking might be different every time that I show it or with every installation. I became somewhat fascinated with this idea, especially with the specimens, because
mm-hmm.
and with the specimen piece too, it changes every time I show it because the configuration of the way that they're laid out is different. I never plan it. It's never really a record of there's never really a record of how it's been shown before. So I don't really try to show it again the same way. I want it to change. I want it to be a different piece every time.
What influences, you know, your choices when you're doing that? I mean, is it the space itself? And you know, what sort of influences your decisions as you're assembling these pieces?
Well, with the specimen piece, when I'm hanging it, I'm trying to make sort of a gridded pattern mm-hmm. to some way to show a kind of order that exists within the piece. And I think with the new piece, the new sculptural piece, the reason mm-hmm. why I want it to change is specifically because of the way that I'm beginning to feel about the landscape or about the way the earth changes. So I want this to be a piece that also changes, and you know, because mm-hmm. because the landscape and because the way that we think about nature changes as we go along in our lives. So.
What are, in your own mind, what are you referring to the building blocks of this sculptural piece? Are they stones? Are they rocks? Are they bricks? Are they big hunks of paint? You know, I mean, you know, how do you think of the parts?
I want it to act both. I want it to sort of be both things.
Mm-hmm.
To be paint and to sort of represent this idea about nature, and I want the paint to represent rocks.
I suppose I'm picturing like a Stonehenge or something of paint, but you know, at some point, do you ever envision like almost creating a cave of paint that, you know, people would sort of immerse themselves in? Or
I think that would be a very fascinating idea. I would just need to be able to find the space that could happen in.
I mean, so. It seems as though, you know, you're really sort of trying to create almost like natural organic shapes, but in a gallery environment with a very, you know, synthetic material, right?
Yeah. I mean, I want my pieces to be sort of reflective, you mm-hmm. know, and I suppose one could say that I could just use rocks or natural objects to create those pieces, because there are earth artists who use rocks or shells.
Right, I'm thinking like Andy Goldsworthy.
Yeah,
you
like
know?
Andy Goldsworthy.
Yeah.
But I think I want my pieces to be a little different than that.
Mm-hmm.
And although I think I find those pieces reflective and there's a lot of philosophy in them, but I'm very fascinated about how paint can, how flexible it is and how it can make us think beyond the material itself.
Mm-hmm.
So how there can be this sort of duality that can happen. That it is paint and it's not, you know, there's sort of this like rough Zen philosophy that something is and it isn't at the same time, you know, and I've always been fascinated with paint, and although there might be other materials I could use, you know.
I think it's important to recognize too, when you're talking about paint, you're talking about, you know, acrylic paint, which is essentially like liquid plastic color, right? I mean, you couldn't do what you do with an oil-based paint, right? Or have you ever tried that before?
You probably could. It would just
take a really long time.
The paint would take longer to dry,
essentially. As people come to see Intersections in March, and you've been working on this, you know, what is it that you're hoping people are going to take away from it as they walk into the Art Box in March and see this new work?
I would hope that they're able to begin to reflect on the pieces and begin to relate them to how we study natural objects, because that's what I'm relating my the way that I make the paintings to from. Is like I'm sort of this amateur scientist kind of artist, you know, that's, you know, roughly interested in science, and I'm setting up these sort of experiments that make paintings. You know, I don't really think of myself as an artist who makes the painting. The painting probably is made through a set of processes,
mm-hmm.
you know, that end up with the piece.
I think that's a great description of it, because, I mean, the work that you do, I mean, it almost, you know, and I've said this to you before, it sort of almost looks like an artist's idea of what work would look, you know, their work would look like in a natural history museum.
Yeah.
And so that scientific approach, it leaves me wondering, I mean, like, this time of year, are you you know, getting inspiration from, you know, what's going on outside. And when you talk about, you know, sort of, you know, rock formations or natural formations, you know, obviously in you see different things in the winter than you do in the summer in terms of, you know, organic structures. You know, are you out, does that have an influence on your work, or, you know, like going outside for, you know, walk in the snow and, you know,
all that,
I bet you would build really cool snowmen. I'm just thinking.
All of that has, does have an influence. But more so, I try to let those influences be ingested,
mm-hmm.
and then sort of come back out in a sort of subconscious, free-flowing way element there in my work.
Well, your work, I mean, is it fair to say it's almost like the work itself becomes the evidence of the process?
Yeah, I think so. Or that a kind of order happens out of not being in control.
Travis DiNicola with artist Mark Pack. His next exhibit will be held at the Art Box Gallery this March. For more information, visit artboxindy.com. Again, artboxindy.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Carmel Community Players continues its season of Pulitzer Prize-winning plays with Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Brian Nofke is directing this 1954 classic for its two-week run at the Carmel Community Playhouse. Sharon Gamble invited CCP's artistic director, Laurie Raffel, to tell us about choosing the Pulitzer Prize season and about bringing Maggie and Brick and company to life on stage.
So before we talk about Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, I want to talk to you about your inspiration for the season. How did you land on the idea of all Pulitzer Prize-winning plays?
Well, this year, in my real job, I work at the Phoenix Theater. I'm a marketing and media relations director there. And when putting the season together, I spoke with Brian Fonseca, and we were having a discussion about creating a season and in the difficult economic times. And he said, go with what the audience knows. And that kept ringing back to me. And I thought, well, how could you go wrong with Pulitzer Prize winners? And when I looked at the list, to me, it was just a cornucopia of wonderful, wonderful theater memories. So that's how I landed on it. And the first director that I went to, Ken Klingenmeyer, I said, I told him what I was thinking about, and he said, I've always wanted to do Rabbit Hole since it came out a few years ago. And once he went with that, then it just kind of went on from there. And when you give directors the choice, normally I like them to bring me what they want to direct, because I think if they have a real passion for it, then they're going to be willing to spend the hours and hours necessary to bring it to life. But I had no problem with the directors looking at the list of Pulitzer Prize winners and all of them coming up with many, many suggestions for what we could do.
How far back do the Pulitzer Prizes go? It's at least 6 or 7 decades, right? Maybe longer?
Yes, I believe the first, it goes back to the 20s.
That sounds right. So that's a huge number of plays to narrow down.
It is.
Do you have a core group? Do you have a kind of a company of directors?
Well, yes, but it's always changing. I mean, we have a few that have lasted throughout the years, but sometimes people either move away and from your venue, or they decide that they want to act or take a sabbatical. And it's always fun to work with the people that you've worked with over and over again, but it's really fun to work with people that you haven't worked with before and see how they direct and what their vision is for each show.
How do you, outside of the fact that some directors are obviously going to fall in love with the idea of, you know, canon, Rabbit Hole, How do you match the director and the play? What, do you have any kind of formula? Is it chemistry? Is it history? Something you've seen them do that you think, oh, he really or she really brought out that in that production I saw across town, so that's the right kind of energy for this piece?
That's very true. And oftentimes I don't tell them that going in, but I steer them in that direction. For instance, when I was working with Brian Nofke, and he had directed for Carmel a few years ago, 10 Little Indians. Although it's a wonderful play, I just didn't feel like it brought out everything he was capable of doing. It was almost, the material was a little too light for him because he's a very intense director and an intense guy. And so when we started talking about the Pulitzer Prize winners, I'm the first one who said, there's a couple from Tennessee Williams that we can look at. And he's then said, how about Cat on a Hot Tin Roof? And to me, that was a good fit because it's people with intense emotions. It's kind of a roller coaster ride. It's a little dysfunctional. And to me, that was just perfect for Brian Nofke because he seems to bring those things to life. You know, he did a wonderful job with Miss Saigon last year at Footlight, which made me think, you know, it would be kind of a waste for him to do a light and frilly comedy, but instead to steer him in the direction of something really intense and with vulnerable characters, and he's doing a great job.
Now, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is, everybody falls in love with it because, armchair psychologist here, in part because their family's more messed up than ours could possibly be, but also it's so fascinating that the characters are so rich and so troubled. But how do you, as an artistic director with your group of folks, how do you capture the unique Southern quality of this play?
Well, that's a good question, and we did do some dramaturgy on it, and, you know, we looked at Tennessee Williams. It started off as a short story, and you kind of look at, and what I did was I looked at the place that he was thinking of, the home that he was thinking of, and where he was when he wrote it, which was a small plantation house in the South, obviously, and it had a lot of character to it. It was not huge. So you could see that the people in there probably fought for everything they had. Mm. It wasn't easy for them. You know, it wasn't a sprawling plantation with, you know, many, many family members and lots of servants. It was smaller. And so to me, that's what all these characters are doing in here. They, you know, it wasn't easy in the South in the 50s. And everyone was kind of grabbing for everything they possibly could hold on to. So we've tried to capture that in, obviously, things like, you know, the costumes, the set, the accents, all those things are so important, and you can never let up, you know, because, you know, when Tennessee Williams writes something, I mean, I've directed John Steinbeck before, and I will tell the actors, don't improv, because there's no one in this room that can speak, you know, better words than John Steinbeck. And so to me, there's no one who can speak better than Tennessee Williams. And so we try to bring every bit of the Southern quality that we can out in, like I said, the characters, the accents, the costumes. And it's been really fun. A real quick note, we talked originally about possibly bringing it into the future, or not future, but present
today?
Day.
Really?
Yes. And honestly, I'm not sure. I wasn't sure which way Brian was going to go, even at audition time.
Huh.
You know, in the end, tradition won out. You know, it's just so perfectly set in that time and space, and those people. I'm not sure that they would transfer well, you know, to 2000.
You'd lose the sense of claustrophobia and so narrow and roles so narrowly defined.
That's exact. Yes, exactly.
I mean, the repressed sexuality is part of that too. That, not that there's no repressed sexuality in 2010. I'm absolutely certain there is. But how do you, as the artistic director, interact with a director once, you know, you've engaged Brian Nofke and said, this is your project, how do you, and I know Michael Long is producing, how,
yes.
Define those three roles for us. How do they intersect and where do they overlap? And or is it different on each project? Is it a chemistry thing?
It is different on each project. And that's kind of what makes it fun and sometimes frustrating. For instance, when you work with Nofke, he is a 100% of the time directing. He doesn't want to have anything to do with the production process, meaning, and that can mean everything from gathering bios to sponsorships to, you know, making sure that the venue is ready when you are building the set. All those things that, to me, a producer does, which is kind of hold the hand of the play throughout the entire process, making sure that everyone stays on budget. And when you work with someone like Brian Nofke, you know that he's not going to think of that.
He needs to save that intensity for the directing.
Yes. Huh. You know, and people, some people, directors will, you know, push the edge of budget and...
Some. I think you're being modest there.
and that's the producer's job is to keep track of that all the time. And I think, you know, for my job, I like to really let the director, they've already told me what their vision is, and I want to let them feel free to create that. But I want to always check in with them. Do you need something from me? What tools can I give you besides money to bring your vision to life? What else can I do for you? And a lot of times they want to talk. They want to talk to someone that they know will just give them honest feedback. And, you know, I don't have, obviously I have, you know, Carmel Community Players. I have them always on the top of my priority list, but I want to make sure that we get wonderful quality theater, too. So it's all kind of a balancing act. And, like, Michael Long is a great producer because he's an organizer. You know, before, barely when you have a cast, he has, you know, this giant Excel spreadsheet of everyone's contact numbers and, you know, the rehearsal schedule, and he's wonderful at that. And so you just kind of learn to match up producers with directors if they don't come together as a set, which sometimes they do.
Huh. So you get to be the like a city planner almost, except you're doing it within theater.
Yes, and I think it's so much about chemistry, as you said, Sharon, because you just have to make sure that the people are there that are going to work well together. And they may not see it right away, but you know, if you know the people involved, you kind of bring them together and you see that, you know, we all have the same goal, and that's to, you know, bring this, like, in particular, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, bring it back to, you know, the people that, the audience, because it's, we have more advanced sales for this show than anything else in the season, and I think that tells you something. I mean, it tells you about the cast, it tells you about the director, but it really tells you about the play. You know, no matter what comes up in contemporary theater, this is just one of those mainstays that, you know, people love to see, you know, Maggie and Brick argue and Big Daddy, you know, come in and throw his weight around, so to speak. And there are some, you know, kids in this show who they didn't know anything about it, nor had they ever read it before.
Wow, that's cool.
Yes.
So you get completely fresh perspective.
Yes. And, you know, it's just, it's fun because, like, in the first, you know, few pages, they call the kids no-neck monsters. And it was hard to explain to the kids exactly what they had
to
be.
What is that?
Yeah. It's just got such a great flavor to it. And it's been really fun to watch it come to life. I mean, that's the most fun of my job is, you know, long ago, a year ago, when I talked to Brian about doing this, and now last night I went and saw the set, and it's just amazing to see it come to life. And everyone involved are volunteers, and they're there because they want to be there.
Sharon Gamble with Lori Raffel, Artistic Director for Carmel Community Players. CCP's production of Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof runs this weekend through Sunday, February 21st, at the 130-seat Carmel Community Playhouse in Clay Terrace Shopping Center at 146th Street and US 31 in Carmel. Tickets are $15 for adults and $12 for students and seniors, and dinner and show packages are available with Kona Grill and Kincaid's. Find out more at carmelplayers.org, where you can also find out about a March 7th benefit event featuring Ben Vereen. Again, carmelplayers.org. Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
You may have noticed something different at the beginning of our show today.
I did indeed. We have a brand new sponsor. It's
so
exciting.
We do have a brand new sponsor.
Woo-hoo.
Which is very cool. The Palladium, which is such a neat name, the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, which is going to be in Carmel.
That's right.
Now, it's not open. It doesn't even open until January of 2011, but they will be sponsoring us.
And they're getting the word out early, which we like.
Good for them. Looking forward to hearing more about them and what they're doing.
Indeed.
We love our new sponsor. So thanks, Palladium.
Thank you so much. And meanwhile, while you're waiting for the Palladium to open in January of 2011, here are some other things you can do right now to celebrate the arts in Central Indiana on our calendar that we call What Do We Do?
Lots going on.
I know.
Always lots of great quality stuff going on. You know what? Something I want to mention that's actually going on down in Bloomington, still within Central Indiana.
Yes.
Coming up February 25th, the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company is performing a piece. It's a tribute to Abraham Lincoln. And this is taking place at the IU Auditorium on the 25th. If you're not familiar with Bill T. Jones, he's an amazing choreographer, and the dance pieces are very, very theatrical. He's won many Tonys. This piece is titled Fondly Do We Hope, Fervently Do We Pray, which is named for a line in Lincoln's second inaugural address. And it's really just this big theatrical dance piece celebrating Abraham Lincoln.
Fabulous.
And if you love dance or theater or Lincoln or all of the above, I would recommend going down. I've got my tickets, looking forward to it very, very much. Bill T. Jones is actually the director of the piece Fella that's on Broadway right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Quite a reputation, quite a talent. Speaking of Lincoln, don't forget at the Indiana State Museum you can now take in the two Lincoln exhibits. And see very different aspects of the personal and political lives of this giant of a man. Those are both going on at the Indiana State Museum, one of them for longer than the other, so go sooner rather than later so you can catch both of them.
There you go. Hey, it is Valentine's this weekend. That's a good reminder.
If your
for those
sweetie
guys
hasn't
out
reminded
there.
You.
Sunday, get your chocolate now. But there's a lot of great stuff going on this weekend you can take your Valentine to. In fact, if you're listening to our show on Friday night, up in Carmel Arts and Design District, they're having their Valentine's Gallery Walk, which goes until 10 o'clock on Friday evening, which should be a lot of fun. And if you're listening Saturday, well, there's still a lot of great galleries up there to go check out.
That's right. You can buy your sweetie some art. Or you can buy your sweetie some tickets to a spring tea tasting March 20th at 1 o'clock at the Morris Butler House. And this is very cool. Travis, I know you drink coffee in the morning and then switch to tea a little bit later in the day.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have a chance at this tea tasting to compare black, green, herbal, and other kinds of teas, including white tea. There will be some instructions so that just as if you heard us at Wine Fest the other day, there are ways that you can educate your palate about different notes in
wine.
It's
all about the sniffing.
It's all about the sniffing. Thank you, Art Black. But in the Victorian era, teas often had very specific uses, some of them medicinal, and of course, the Morris Butler House is a Victorian era living history museum. So March 20th is when the tea tasting is coming up, and you can find out lots more by going to historiclandmarks.org. That's who owns and operates the Morris Butler House.
Very neat. Hey, a concert going on Saturday, the 13th, the Saturday night, 8 p.m. at Unitarian Universalist Church of Indianapolis. Free spirits and free improvisation. Celebrate love from every angle, including the good, the bad, and the ugly. You can come hear Thin Air, which is an instrumental improv group that features Sally Childs-Helton, Diana Davis, Pam Blevins-Hinkle, Shannon McGuire and Liz Abramson. And they will be joined by the Indianapolis Women's Chorus, as well as members of the small ensemble Symphonia, and it's all improvised. It should be a lot of fun.
I have heard them before. They are kind of wild women. I'll just put that out there. And I mean that in a good way.
Of course.
Speaking of concerts, something a little less improvisational, but still a lot of fun, the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra is doing something a little unusual. They are accompanying a double feature silent film screening on Friday, February 26th at the Toby. That's the Indianapolis Museum of Art's Tobias Theater. The films Buster Keaton's One Week and Harold Lloyd's Safety Last.
I can't wait. This is going to be so much fun.
So fun. So, you know, if I said Harold Lloyd and you pictured that clock scene where he's sort of dangling off of a big clock on a tower, that is from Safety Last. So go see it in its original context on Friday, February 26th. Take your sweetie and you can call it a Valentine's present.
Very cool. Hey, that same night, there's also the big art show down at Art Box that's supporting Art for Beds and the Genesaret Clinic. And there's going to be Warhols and Lichtensteins and Rauschenberg and all types of great contemporary artists as part of that. That should be a really great event,
too. A full dance card that night, right?
Yeah. Hey, some more stuff going on this weekend, of course, that you can take your sweetie to. My Fair Lady, a musical concert at the Indianapolis Civic Theater all weekend long, the 12th, 13th, and 14th. And it will just be fun, of course, because music direction by Brent Marty. So how could it not be?
Absolutely. Brent Bell, who has written several fabulous books about art and the divine, including The Art of Faith, has organized a couple of workshops that are coming up on next Saturday the 20th and the following Saturday the 27th. The first one on the 20th will be at Quaker Hill Conference Center in Richmond, Indiana, so you can go to the Richmond Art Museum before or after that. And the second one will be at Lockerbie Central United Methodist Church in Indianapolis. And these workshops are about awakening your five senses to encounter the spiritual in your life and in yourself. They're sensory and participatory, using various artistic media. Now, in all caps, he says in the announcement, no artistic ability is required, just come with a playful, exploratory spirit. If you go to theartoffaith.net, you can find out lots more.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Hey, something going on down at University of Indianapolis, a play that you don't get many opportunities to see.
Ooh, which
the
one?
Good Person of Szechuan, also sometimes known as The Good Lady of Szechuan, depending on the translation. It's the Bertolt Brecht play. Mm-hmm. And if you're not familiar with Brecht, then this will be a great opportunity to see a really different type of theater. It's not exactly meant to be a realistic portrayal. It's a whole different style of theater that presents itself knowing that it's theater in a way that really sort of confronts the audience, and it should be really interesting. It opens next weekend and runs the following weekend as well at Esch Hall in the Randsburg Auditorium. This is a student production being directed by Jen Alexander from the faculty there at University of Indianapolis, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. It's sort of an interesting story about three gods who come to Earth in search of a thoroughly good person, and they encounter this woman, Shen Tei, who's this penniless prostitute who offers them shelter, and she's rewarded, and then it starts dealing with all these issues about what is right and wrong, and the demands of people seeking her assistance, that she has to actually sort of create an evil ego to combat it. Tricky story.
Yeah.
Tricky play.
Good challenge for student theater.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey, Heather Galloway Vickers, who is an artist and teaches art at Heron High School here in Indianapolis, you've probably seen her work on display at Editions Limited Gallery in Broad Ripple. She is doing an online art auction on eBay to benefit the St. John's Storehouse, which is a West Side food pantry that benefits more than 100 families a month. It's a ministry of St. John's Episcopal Church. And get this, she's donating 100% of the proceeds from the auction to repair the roof of the St. John's Storehouse. So if you go to eBay and search for Heather Galloway Vickers, you can find her beautiful landscapes, and she's auctioning several of them off for a very good cause. So good art, good cause.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, some more theater at the Phoenix Theater opening next weekend is the National New Play Network, the NNPN, Rolling World Premiere of Sunlight. And so this is a play that's premiering at different places over the course of this season. And it was the winner of the 2009 Edgerton Foundation New American Play Award. It's a political thriller, and it should be very cool at the Phoenix Theater.
Fans of new music will know the name of composer Joan Tower. She will be a special guest at DePauw. You know, DePauw has a special fondness for contemporary music, new music, music of the 21st century. And Joan Tower will be in town Friday, February 18th through Sunday the 21st for all sorts of great events. So you can get on Google or Yahoo or whatever your search engine of choice is and find out more about Joan Tower at DePauw.
Very cool. Hey, last thing I want to mention is almost every day through the month of February, there's free performances taking place at the Arts Garden downtown as part of Art and Soul, the celebration of African-American art and artists in Indiana through the Arts Council.
Take your sweetie or find a new one.
That's right.
Well,
there's
you should.
So
you better not
no,
do
no,
that.
No, 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 no.
What are you getting
so
for Valentine's Day?
I can't tell you. She might be listening.
Oh. So. What do you want for Valentine's Day?
I can't tell you
wasn't
that
there wasn't there fly fishing equipment
we
on
don't
this
talk about that anymore, Sharon.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, but we will be back next week as we continue this vibe on
what will we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
about an hour and 15 minutes from Indianapolis, the Richmond Art Museum in Richmond, Indiana, is a fine art museum with a permanent collection of American Impressionists, Taos School, the Hoosier Group, the Richmond School, and other regional artists. They're also offering classes with Indianapolis artist Douglas David and are currently featuring the Fantascope High School Film Festival, a juried short film festival in its fourth year of films created by teen filmmakers. Travis DiNicola spoke with Education Director Lance Crow about the museum.
Lance, welcome to Art of the Matter. It's great to be chatting with you, even if it's by phone today.
Yes, it's great to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. I'm really excited to hear about what has been going on at the Richmond Art Museum and the things that you guys have coming up. And I'm also embarrassed to say that I've not been out there yet. I know it's only like, an hour and 15 minutes from Indianapolis, so I have no excuse.
Yes, not too far, just down the road. But there is a lot going on, and the museum's been here for quite some time. So
you guys, actually, you've been around for more than, 100 years or so, and have a pretty, I think it sounds like a very well-respected permanent collection.
Yeah, it really is. We were founded in 1898, so that puts us in our 111th year.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a great American Impressionist collection, as well as Hoosier Group and Richmond School. Artists in our collection, as well as some arts and crafts movement and the Overbeck Sisters and Bethel Pike Potters pottery. So it's a pretty, it's more nationally known collection rather than regionally, but it's a great collection nonetheless.
Tell me a little bit about the Richmond School, because I'm certainly familiar with the Hoosier Group, but not as familiar with what comprises the Richmond School.
Well, there are several artists, but probably the most well-known would be John Elwood Bundy, and he was a great watercolorist and oil painter, loved to paint beech trees and cows and the landscape around this area. So he was probably the most well-known from that school.
Okay. And what time period is that? And is
it, it's right around when the museum was founded.
Okay.
The early Richmond School artists were, some of them were integral in founding the Richmond, was called the Art Association of Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
At that time. And so they were integral in sort of building this this movement here in this place as it stands.
In addition to the permanent collection that you have, you also have a lot of different events coming up. One featuring one of my favorite Indianapolis artists, Douglas David, who's just known for his great landscapes, sometimes featuring cows, beautiful paintings of peonies. In fact, a couple years back, Doug had an exhibit of his work, a solo show at the Richmond Art Museum that, in fact, included a publication, a book of those paintings.
Yes, he did, and it was very successful, and we've just maintained our relationship with Douglas David and feel very fortunate to have him as one of our teachers here at the museum. And he's taught in Florida and Michigan and made his rounds, but this will be his first time teaching in Indiana.
Okay, yeah.
So this is sort of his debut class here in Indiana, and we're really just pleased that he's chosen the Richmond Art Museum for the venue. So I really just want to promote that class and build the interest in it so that people will come and we can fill it up for them.
And that's running from March through May, is that correct?
Yes, it'll actually be sort of broken up into two classes. One will be a still life oil painting, focusing on still lifes, fruits and vegetables and things like that. And then the other six week session will be landscape oil painting. So it'll be focusing on landscape and the difference between the two. And you can sign up for both classes or each session individually.
Now, for classes like this, do people need to be trained artists, or is it something that novices can jump in as well, or is it really something more for an advanced student?
I would say that for Douglas's class, you might want to be a little bit more on the advanced side. But we have many other classes that any level of student would be able to participate in.
Mm-hmm. And so you have a on-site at the museum. It sounds like an education area, classroom.
Actually, what we've been able to do is, since we're housed here at the Richmond High School, we're able to use the art classes that the high school students use. So It's a nice way to build, give the community access to the school building as well.
Oh, okay. I didn't actually realize how that was set up. So are you actually located in the high school or connected to it?
Yes,
or?
When the Richmond High School was built, we were built an arts wing called McGuire Memorial Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we're housed. And as far as we know, we're the only active public art museum housed in an active public high school today in the United States, as far as we know. So it's a pretty unique situation.
Well, that must be a great opportunity for the high school students there.
Yes, it is. It's very good. We have we have 6 or 7 exhibits per year, and out of those, each artist spends at least one day with the high school art students.
Now, one thing I know you're also doing with high school students, this is something actually pretty unique. It's the fourth year for your film festival for teen filmmakers, the Fantascope Festival, and specifically for teenagers, for high school students who want to submit films, right?
Yes, you're correct. It's the fourth annual Fantascope High School Film Festival, and the name comes from a motion picture device. It's the first motion picture device. It was invented by a man named C. Francis Jenkins. He called it the Fantascope, and he was from the Richmond area. So we've tried to make a historical connection with our cultural roots here in Richmond. And the first movie, quote-unquote movie, was publicly shown here in Richmond in 1894 by C. Francis Jenkins on a Fantascope.
Wow. Now, I heard about this, and I was, I guess I always thought that, the first screening of a movie was, in New York or something. And tell me about what you know about the Fantascope and the screening of that movie back in 1894.
Well, we don't know much other than it was shown on the wall of a jewelry store in downtown Richmond after C. Francis Jenkins had come home for, I believe it was his brother's or one of his relatives' wedding. And he showed a ballet dancer or something, and people were enraptured by the beautiful movements.
Wow. Now, do you know much about the device? I mean, was it, as we think of an old projector now, I mean, with film moving through, and a light projecting the image, or
it was something similar than that, but it was very clunky and boxy. It looked like a rectangle of plywood with some with a lens on the front of it, and then every motion picture device that he developed from then on, every improvement he made was called a Fantascope. So there's these really old, junky-looking Fantascopes, and then there's the newer-looking with the reels and stuff on them.
Okay.
So.
Well, now, the high school kids who are participating in the film festival will most likely not be using original Fantascopes, probably. I'm guessing using their iPods more likely.
Yes.
Now, this festival actually takes place. The screening is going to be on Saturday, April 10th. But prior to that, you're accepting applications from essentially what, all over the state, both Indiana and Ohio?
Yes, all of Indiana, and we've sent to schools in western Ohio as well. And what we'll be doing is accepting submissions. We had our early submission date, which was February 2nd, and so now we'll be accepting the final submissions on March 2nd. So if anybody has films out there, any high school student, it can be public, private, or homeschool student, just have to be in that age range to submit.
And now the entry fee is only $10. And
yes.
And what are the parameters for what students can submit?
Well, one of the things that makes our competition unique is that we don't really have any themes or anything like that to the competition. We just want to see original and creative material, and we just want to encourage and foster this creativity and vision in young and upcoming screenwriters and filmmakers, so that we can see just some of the originality of what they can come up with.
In 15 minutes or less?
In 15 minutes or less,
okay.
Yes.
So what type of stuff have you seen in the past with the other the previous festivals?
Well, there have been some really neat things. last year's winner was just a great editing job of stills, and it was sort of a love story, a very short love story about someone's first love. There's been sort of a Disney-esque film with about two dogs, and they've been voiced over. There have been some little action movies. So, you know, just really the whole range. It's amazing what some of these students can come up with.
Well, that's great. And then is there a prize for best winner?
Yes, the best picture receives a $500 top prize. And then we also give prizes for best actor and actress, best screenplay, best editing, different things like that as well.
Excellent.
Recognize the best of the best.
I'm sure it's a great night with all the filmmakers coming together, too, as well, and just getting a chance to meet each other and see what other teenagers are creating.
It really is, and you know, that's also just teens don't have the opportunity to show their films in front of a live audience normally, you know, unless it's just their parents or friends or whatever, but you know, that audience reaction is sort of invaluable to a filmmaker because they don't get that very often. And, you know, films screen a lot differently in a vacuum, and, you know, rather than in front of a live audience. So that's a great experience for them. And we do have an educational component to the Phantoscope, which is, you know, we have a panel of experts who are currently working in the film or film industry, and they get to ask questions, the how-to questions, you know, how do you get involved, or what steps should I take to, mm-hmm. to further my my career in this field. So it's a great event.
Well, it sounds fantastic. I'm sure you're all looking forward to it. Of course, there's more information on your website about how to submit for Phantoscope, as well as how to sign up for painting classes, whether with Douglas David or with other artists who are teaching classes at the Richmond Art Museum. Well, Lance, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you and learning about the RAM. It's okay. You guys call it the RAM, right? That's the nickname for it?
Yeah. Yeah.
All righty. Okay. Well, Lance, well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Richmond Art Museum Education Director Lance Crowe. For more information about the museum, visit richmondartmuseum.org, richmondartmuseum.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 when I find out what's new with Richard Alden Clark and the Butler Symphony Orchestra.
And I'll chat with Jim Nolte, president of VSAI. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Will We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.